Hello and welcome to the first Brewing Podcast of 2019. And with that, Happy New Year to you all. So today we speak to Simon Brazier, the lead manager on the Investec UK Alpha Fund. And we talk markets and stocks, and all remarkably with relatively few mentions of Brexit. Croda, for example, one stock we discuss, should really suffer very little impact from the whole political soap opera. And here's just a brief comment from Simon detailing one reason why this ought to be the case.
Well, the amazing bit about Croda is the diversification of their product set. I mean, they are selling to thousands of customers in hundreds of different product verticals.
So for more comment on that company, as well as Relics, Breedon, the UK House Builders, and the market environment at large, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest Brewin podcast and the first of the new year. So take this opportunity to wish you all a very prosperous new year and to thank you for your support in 2018. But getting on to today, we are going to be looking at UK equities and delighted to be able to host perhaps the most coveted fund manager in the city, Simon Brazier of Investec, who amongst his many roles is lead manager on their UK Alpha Fund. Simon, happy new year to you.
Happy new year. Flattery will get you everywhere, but I'm not sure that's true, but happy to be here.
Well, we'll see what we can coax out of you in this 20 minutes. What I thought a good thread would be to first, you know, the very unfair question about, you know, where you think markets are going this year. A lot to talk about in that regard, but we want to try and condense that because we do want to spend a bit of time talking about companies and companies that I think you're most excited about for the year ahead. And as a teaser, I think we're looking at Croda, Relics and Breedon. It would be my guess, in that you emailed me, that's the ones you want to talk about. So let's start off with that tricky market question. It appears that UK equities are looking pretty cheap, but of course there is no shortage of, among other things, political risks, if not sort of economic cycle risks. So, you know, how are you weighing up the market at the moment? Does it look attractive to you or does it look less so?
Well, the easy answer is to say, of course, the UK is attractive as a UK fund manager and particularly relative to other asset classes and other equity markets. And that certainly would be the case. But being honest, in absolute terms, I sit here today, beginning of the year, and there are two big, and you mentioned them, currency and economics, and I haven't mentioned politics, but they're interrelated, are going to determine this year in my mind. And you know, I was listening to the radio the other day and there was a currency specialist saying that their range of outcomes for sterling against the dollar was 25% down and 15% up. I mean, that's a 40% range in sterling, which has a huge impact on markets in terms of, you know, the companies that are exporting and ones with their input costs and everything. And that relates to what happens with the political outcome. On top of that, the political outcome also therefore affects the economics. You know, I still remain relatively concerned about the outlook for the UK economy per se, particularly the consumer. I mean, I don't think we've seen the consumer downturn yet. And the savings ratio, which is very, very low. Sorry, the savings ratio is very low in terms of we are basically not saving at the moment. And if you were to see an increase of that ratio, that cuts consumer spending and, you know, the economy would find it difficult. So, being honest, the outcome for this year is not only binary, but it's completely uncertain.
Yeah.
And so I'm just trying to stick to the knitting on owning good quality companies, which is a really easy thing to say. But actually, you know, at times you have to take risk as a fund manager. You know, but I just do not think now is the time to be taking that risk. And I want to mitigate economic risk, currency risk, but also liquidity risk, which you may come onto.
Well, what does that mean then as a fund manager? You know, if you look at sort of Brexit stocks. I don't know if you want to take house builders, for example. Yeah. Do you go neutral on them, or do you have zero weight? Because
so I'm very simple about this. Which
or other consumer related domestic stories.
Yes, I'm very simple on this, which is our framework we look at stocks through, the prism is, if I can find a company that I can own through the economic cycle because it has a strong business model, it's going to grow. I'm pretty much confident it will grow its profits. So we'll talk about Reed and Croda later, Relics as it's now later. I'm pretty confident those companies are going to grow their profits come what may in terms of the economics and politics this year. Has a good financial model. Has a good balance sheet. Those are both two companies who have got effectively net debt EBITDA of 1x. They don't have much issues with their balance sheets. And capital allocation have got management teams who I don't think are going to blow them up by making stupid decisions. If I can find those sort of businesses, I'll own them all the time. Now, and that is 2/3 of my portfolio typically. But I've always said I've been prepared to buy companies where you are taking more risk, i.e. cyclical companies, which I think you want to find ones that have got good financial models and good capital allocation, but they don't have good business models. So house builders is one. House builders do not have ultimately a great business model. There'll be times in the economic cycle where you will not want to own a house builder because, and we saw this back in 2008, 2009, because people will put on hold their buying purchases, cash flow disappears out the window, and suddenly the valuations look very, very expensive relative to cash flow. Because they do not have, there is not a guarantee that everyone every single month is going to want to go and buy houses. Whereas actually, Croda, they're selling shampoo, which people do buy. Well, they're selling the products that go into shampoo. And so right now, in those cyclical stocks, I want a valuation that protects me for any downside risk in the economy. And it's quite difficult to find companies where that valuation is there. So in UK house builders, I was buying them on half book value in 2010. So if half of the value of the written down land on their balance sheets. I sold them all in 2015 on 2 to 2.5 times book value. Today, you're looking at a range of 0.8 to 1.8 times book value. Not cheap enough for me to take the risk of a downturn in the UK economy. So I won't buy them. It's not about being neutral, I just won't own them. And so if you looked at my portfolio, the number of stocks in my portfolio today compared to 2015 has gone from 85 to 48. The amount of cyclicality in my portfolio, so when I look at the cyclical sectors, has been reduced by about 20%. So we've been selling cyclicals and buying high quality stocks. We've been selling cyclicals and buying more restructuring recovery stocks. And that's what we've been doing in the portfolio. And we are, although, last caveat, I have what I call the bench. There are 20 stocks which I would happily own at the right valuation. I don't mind mentioning a few of them. Some of them I used to own before. Ryanair, EasyJet, Rotork, Next. Companies at the right valuation I'm happy to buy. And we're getting close to some of those valuations. There's new ones, that Cranswick, Genus, which are companies which I think are excellent businesses, but where the valuation for me at the moment is still a little bit too high. But we may get that opportunity.
Okay, so on a medium-term view, feel very optimistic about this strategy. Well, even on a short-term view, I'm sure, but on a relative basis, if you get something close to a Brexit solution, or you get, sort of Chinese stimulus, these sort of high growth things that could really sort of propel growth, this fund may be left wanting on a relative basis. This has this sort of defensive quality at the moment, does it?
It has a defensive quality relative to where it's been.
Yeah.
But I would also point out that I see myself as a core manager that's diversified. So it's not like I don't have any cyclicality in my portfolio at all. I own UK banks, I own Lloyds, I own Barclays. We're going to come and talk about Breed and Aggregates. I mean, when you asked me what stocks I wanted to talk about, I could have given you three surefire stocks. I mean, Breeden, you are taking risk on owning Breeden. It is clearly exposed to infrastructure chain trends in the UK.
Okay, well, let's go there with Breeden now.
Let's go to Breeden. I mean, so for Breeden, for me, is look, there is clearly risk in owning Breeden. The balance sheet is relatively stretched because of the recent deal it did, which is buying a business called Lagan in Ireland. Having said that, Lagan, I think the restructuring they'll make within that business of Lagan and the cash flows that will come will justify that decision. I think it's going to be proved to be a good acquisition, and the debt will then come down as the cash flows come through. But at this point in time, Breeden is probably as geared as it has been. It's got cyclical risk. There is no doubt if the UK economy goes into recession, then by definition, house building, most of their stuff is infrastructure products, government funded, but there will be an impact on earnings from that. But having said that, why do I like Breeden? Why is it one of the three stocks I want to talk about? It's because, one, it has self-help. In terms of
restructuring that Lagan business that they bought, taking synergies out of that business, and also growing their business off the back of Lagan is going to be very important. Two, I actually think there is a defensiveness to it, because I do believe that whatever the outcome is of Brexit, if you look at, for example, if you look at the OBR's forecast for government investment spend in 2019, it's currently 5.7% growth. 3 years ago, their 2019 forecast was flat.
Yeah.
So clearly government is going to be putting in more investment spend into roads, into big infrastructure projects, which will support Breedon. And on top of that, at the end of the day, it's run by one of the best, well, the executive chairman, Peter Thom, is one of the best executives I've ever met. You know, he built Aggregate Industries up in the late 90s, early 2000s, sold it to Holcim, it's a FTSE 100 business, yeah. And he's now doing exactly the same with Breedon Aggregates. This guy knows every quarry in the UK, he knows every, you know, person in the industry, and he's someone who runs that business very efficiently. And so I'm happy to put my client's capital with him, because I know he will look after it very well.
And they're finished, have they, on their acquisition trail?
No, this is a roll-up strategy. So, you know, I think when debt comes back off again, but also he has a good supportive bunch of shareholders who will, each time he raises money to do a new deal, he comes to see us, he says, this is a deal we're looking at.
Fail-safe shareholders, come what may,
and that's a really good question, which is that it is very rare as a fund manager for me. I'm a cynic. If someone wants to come and raise money from me, they have to give a very, very good reason for that. And it to be, you know, which is why I'm always been relatively cynical about IPOs, because there's not a track record. I mean, I started, you know, working in the city in the late 90s, and Peter Thom, I knew then. I mean, I've known this guy for 20 years, and he's, you know, he has delivered for 20 years. And so I will trust him in terms of, you know, of course, we look at the deals, we do our own analysis. But, you know, he's someone I would trust and has got a very, very good track record in rolling out an acquisition strategy within aggregates industries in the UK.
And so sorry, for clarity for our listeners, I mean, the makeup of their revenues, is it explicitly UK?
Yeah, explicitly UK. Because the one thing that doesn't travel very well, as you might imagine, is aggregates.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very localised industry. If you're building a ring road around, I'm making this up, Basingstoke in Hampshire, you're not bringing the aggregates down from Scotland, let alone the Midlands, because obviously it's relatively cheap, but very heavy. And so actually it's a very localised industry. And Peter, through acquisition, now has those quarries across the UK that he's able to serve those local markets. Also, he's obviously he has a cement business as well. So, you know, there is Hope was there. Big acquisition they made a few years ago, which has a large quarry, a large cement plant, one of the large cement plants in the UK. Today, there's huge barriers to entry. No one would build a cement plant today. I mean, very expensive to build, and the returns that you would get off building that excess supply, you wouldn't be worth it. So it's a market where there are high barriers to entry, where he owns the aggregate, it's asset backed. He owns 40 years worth of aggregates, I think. And it's localised, and you're competing in those local markets to deliver the best product on the best time.
And the makeup of the market is sort of the public sector, which actually may benefit from a tricky Brexit.
Well, that's my point.
But versus the private sector.
A majority of his revenues is coming from effectively government finance. A lot of it's local authority funded, but it is built infrastructure, public ring roads, etc.
Okay, all right. Well, let's move on to perhaps slightly better known companies. I mean, RELX is sort of an exciting one, AI story.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
You've been doing your research. Just for all your listeners, it used to be called Reed Elsevier. Reed.
Yeah.
Changed its name to RELX or RELX, RELX, whatever you want to call it. But I used to own Pearson back in the day, and I sold my Pearson to increase my RELX. Because I felt that RELX was a business that had gone from print to online technology much better. And so effectively, it's the main businesses are scientific, legal, medical, technical. So it's things like the Lancet, in medical. It's LexisNexis, which is, the go-to repository of information on court cases around the world. And what they've been very, very successful in doing is bringing all these things online. And, you know, so if you are a university library, you are paying, and it is subscription revenue. Over 50% of their revenue is subscription. So, you know, all things being equal, a library at Durham University, I'm making it up, will renew their subscription to get access to the same scientific journals next year as they did this year. A legal firm will renew its subscription to get access to LexisNexis. You know, doctors will renew their subscription to The Lancet and all the other medical journals. But on top of that, they also have a fantastic risk and business analytics business. They're using their data. So, for example, if you are...
Well, we come back to the scientific data. Yeah. Sort of our understanding that a bit of the share price pressure last year came from the idea of these papers sort of becoming free on the internet, sort of open architecture and authors simply pay to publish these
notes. Our analyst did a big piece of work on that, and his conclusion was very clear that there is clearly around the margins this is happening. But at the end of the day, and I mean, there was an article I read only yesterday in the press about I think he was from Canada, a scientist who basically just made up a bunch of scientific papers and got 7 of the 10 published because on peer review sites.
Yeah.
And having copied out he just copied out of a book. He was trying to prove that a lot of this was sort of farcical.
Yeah, so it does present a lot of conflict,
the point being, actually, people will still pay to make sure they are in the journals which count, where actually it is properly peer reviewed.
Yeah.
And so a lot of stuff that's happening on the internet is deemed not to be necessarily.
So the Lancet still has that sort of stamp of quality.
Yeah, stamp of quality. So there is nowhere else in the world you can go if you want every single, bit of case law in the UK going back 200 years. I mean, that is a huge barrier to entry. Yeah. You will use LexisNexis, for example. So I think they've put that argument to bed. This is a company that's still growing. It's organically 4-5%. So high subscription revenue. 70% of the revenues are from online technology-based products. And it's relatively defensive. And on top of that, you've got this lovely business in terms of coming onto the risk and business analytics, where a bit like Experian, which is another business I own, where you're taking all that data you have and then putting it into a more user-friendly way for businesses to be able to use that data to improve their businesses. So, for example, insurance companies in the US use their data to work out because it's actually very difficult to get data in the US across the country outside individual states, but Reed has that data. So if you're a car insurance company in the US, it's about the only place you can go to, because actually you don't always, in the UK, you quote in the UK, and you if you quote in, I don't know where you live, Ben, say in Fulham or somewhere, they've got data on lots of people in Fulham. But in the US, often someone will apply for a car insurance and no one has ever applied for car insurance within 50 miles of that postcode. But they have a lot of data which enables to give better information to companies.
And the exhibition business is nice.
Sorry, we're completely forgotten. They own one of the top two exhibition businesses in the world. This is a more cyclical business, clearly. But they run 500 exhibitions a year globally. Good quality business. But again, it's relatively defensive, which is, at the margin, companies may decide, I won't go to that exhibition this year. But actually, most of the industries they are in, the exhibition is a key part of your selling program for your business through the year. And so again, these are good quality businesses with decent margins.
Okay, and we'll come on to the final company then, which is Croda. It'd be hard for us to argue much of a bear case for any of this sort of lines of revenue. We think it's an excellent company, but I mean, we'd be interested to hear your take on
Croda.
Which obviously itself gives you great comfort, I'm sure, that we think it's
Good to hear that Bruce, Croda is a chemicals business. But it's a speciality chemicals business, so it's not in mass chemicals. It produces chemicals which have an active effect on the end product, and they're typically a small part of the end product. So it goes into things like shampoos, it goes into healthcare products, plastic additives, industrial products. But because it's a small part of the end product, Croda gets pricing power. But it's very difficult if you are making shampoo, for you not to include, I'm making this up, in your Pantene Pro-V, you take the Pro-V out, it's not quite as an attractive product.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the active ingredient. And it's a business that has high margins, it's very focused on cash flow, it reinvests its cash flow at high rates of return, 20% rates of return, and it's relatively defensive. And the other bit we like is it's, you know, I always get challenged, particularly on the sort of consumer staples areas, saying, well, Simon, you know, the Reckitts, Benckisers and the Unilevers, they're all being challenged by the, you know, the disruptors in those industries. The great thing about Croda is they've been prepared to work with not only the multinationals, but also some of the independents who, you know, in soap and in shampoo and all sorts of other areas. So they're sort of agnostic to where the market ends up going. But what they do have is they have the active ingredient, which makes your product differentiated and sellable.
I mean, does it these ingredients, I mean, I'm sure they will find their way into some sort of luxury skincare, but I'm just sort of wondering, because we've seen pretty challenging numbers out of China of late. I mean, is that something that at all that could weigh on Croda's performance?
Yes and no, because I mean, yes, it would maybe within that part, but the amazing bit about Croda is the diversification of their product set. I mean, they are selling to thousands of customers in hundreds of different product verticals. So at one point in time where they may be, say, you know, a reduction in demand for their end customers in a certain moisturising product, maybe in China, but at the same time, they're probably getting demand elsewhere in an industrial product in Japan. I don't know. But yeah, it's just the diversification of their product. They're just not reliant on any one product at all.
Okay. And I guess price might be a concern.
You mean valuation?
Valuation, sorry. Yeah.
I mean, look, I would say that Croda certainly sits in the more, you know, you're paying 20 odd times earnings to buy Croda, but the balance sheet is very strong. I mean, it will, if it did no more acquisitions, or it would have no debt within 2 years. And so it's a company that we probably expect will return us some cash in the short to medium term. So yes, it's a relatively expensive company, but you know what? As I said, I think at the beginning, I think you still will have to pay up for companies to give you certainty in this uncertain world. And we believe Croda will do that. Again, it's another company that's growing its organic top line growth at 4-5%, relatively defensive. So I'm prepared to pay that premium to the market for what's a very high quality company with limited balance sheet risk, if any, and actually the opportunity for them to return us cash.
So sort of reaching for bear points here, but I mean, is there any sort of hidden, not necessarily hidden, but cyclical elements to it? I know it sort of tries to help efficiency, doesn't it, in more cyclical industrial parts of the market?
It is definitely, it does have an industrials division.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first looked at Croda 20 years ago, it was, you wouldn't call it a speciality chemicals business. It did a lot of much more bulk chemicals, but it has basically exited those and found these more specialist niches. But it, you know, to be clear, there is a part, like the exhibitions business of Reckitts, the industrials part where it goes into additives, into paints and the like, where if you saw an industrial downturn, then clearly it would be affected in that division.
Okay, Simon, well, we've had over 20 minutes of your precious time there. So we're really grateful for those incredibly insightful thoughts on the businesses and the markets at large, and sort of reiterating, you know, what a difficult market this is. So thanks very much for your time. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed that. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, whatever platform you listen to this podcast through. But until next time, many thanks for listening.